Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with George Novelle-Neal. George is a top international executive, software developer entrepreneur, and ACM chair. George, you've just got a remarkable background, such a long history of success, and so many outstanding contributions, both in the from the public side and also on the private side. Thank you for sharing so much of your wisdom with our audience.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, George, from your early years up to the present, can you share a few notable events leading to your current roles?
Sure. I mean, a few of the things that I've done. I started, like most people of my generation who I know in computer science, people who sort of started programming as teenagers in the 80s, working with computers before I had any actual formal training. So spent a lot of time programming a lot of 8-bit micros, learning assembly language. I wound up teaching the Fortran class in my high school for one semester. Just had a lot of early experience, hands-on experience with computing technology before I went and took a computer science degree. I'd say a lot of the experiences in my educational background are, mixed academic and also hands-on. I went to Northeastern University, which is well-known for having a co-op program. So I spent a good deal of time working in industry as well as taking classes. And that actually really set the tone for my career because I've always spent half my time looking at the academic side of things, in particular my work with ACM, but also in developing courseware and teaching, both in industry and working with universities, as well as, working in corporate environments and developing software as a practitioner.
I'm always amazed at your eclectic background. I understand you speak a few languages. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You mean human languages as opposed to computer languages. Like many American high school students, went through the languages programs of my high school, which were pretty appalling. And but did discover that upon traveling, I really enjoyed languages and that they were, for me, relatively easy to pick up. So I spent nearly a year in Holland and wound up speaking Dutch by the time I left there. I spent 4 years living in Japan, and I still speak Japanese quite a bit. Even the bits of French that I picked up in high school once I went to France actually made some sense. So I wind up picking up languages wherever I go. It's just sort of a hobby of mine. I can't stand to be in a place where I can't read the menu, order food, or get a hotel room. So the moment I land somewhere, I learn the important words, which are yes, no, please, thank you, and I would like.
That's interesting. Now, George, you are the chair of the practitioner board of the ACM. First of all, can you tell us a little bit more about the ACM and then about the board's key projects and wins, including for 2015 and 16, and the value to the computing professionals that are out there?
Sure. I mean, for people who don't really know ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery is the largest professional society for people working in computer science. It has a long history starting in the 20th century, shortly after computers actually became something that people used for actual work and research. My involvement with ACM actually started as a student member in college. So I've been a member of the ACM since I was an undergraduate. And then, I've always been involved in one way or another, either being a member of the association or even before I became head of the practitioner board, I was a member of the editorial board for Q magazine, the practitioner magazine that ACM puts out. 2 years ago, I was asked to head up the practice board by Steve Bourne, who had headed it for me, and to help ACM formulate its direction and how it's going to, address a really large practitioner community. When ACM started, the number of people who were using computers day-to-day was minuscule, and now the number of people who are, whose job involves computing technology is massive, and it's one of the fastest-growing areas of work between the 20th and 21st centuries. So the practice board, it's a group of people both from academia and from industry who try to figure out what are the best things we can do to help to educate practitioners about interesting research that they might use to build products and build systems and improve systems, and also to take the lessons learned in industry and reflect them back into academia. We try to act as a bridge between those two communities. So, you know, I've mentioned Q. Q Magazine is a sort of a 11 year now production of ACM that is targeted directly at computing professionals. In 2015, we had our first applicative conference, which was well attended. We had 200 attendees at a conference in New York City where we had a two-track, two-day conference that delved into both the system side of software as well as the application side of software. And that went extremely well, was really well received. Sami Albarra and Terry Cota, who were both practice board members, really ran the conference, did an amazing job. And they had signed up to do it again for 2016. So we're getting ready to do that in 2016. We have a couple other efforts going on. We're going to have Q Magazine coming out as an app on iOS and Android in the fall of 2015. So we're really looking forward to that. We produced a series of video portraits of sort of up-and-coming practitioners in the art of computer science. That was done in 2014. This year, we're starting a new video series that will probably debut at the same time that the app does in the fall. We're also looking at creating a new ACM journal, not a submission-type journal, but a journal that looks into recent academic publications and tries to formulate them for the practitioner.
So there's a lot of value content going out to practitioners to enable them to grow their careers and to get insights into what's out there, and especially from the ACM, which is such a prestigious leading body in the field. What are some noteworthy outcomes from Applicative 2015, and what are your goals for 2016?
I think the biggest outcome was the success of Applicative. We had never really tried, the practice board had never tried to put on a conference before. And, you know, putting on a two-track, two-day conference is a non-trivial effort. And so that really, I think that was an amazing thing that we did. And, you know, if you look to content in Q in the fall, you'll see that almost every one of the people who gave a presentation at the conference also signed up to turn their presentation into an article. So for those people who were not able to make the conference, we'll still be able to get the content via Q Magazine. 2016, I think the big thing is going to be we're going to do Applicative again, bigger, better, the usual kinds of things you try to do once a conference has been initially successful. And then talking again about the Q app, that's going to be a big thing for us in 2016 because that's going to be how we're going to deliver practitioner content from, you know, ACM to practitioners. Right now, Q exists as a website, and that's one way to reach people, but we find that having a publishing event, you know, something that comes out every other month that, you know, shows up in your device and you get a little blue dot that says go get the new one or, you know, gets delivered, and there's all this slew of content that comes down. We find that is a really good way to reach people. And our other goal in 2016 is to try and get more practitioners who are not currently members of ACM to see the value of being members of ACM and to actually join. So the content we're generating isn't just for members, it's basically for the entire community, and to try and, you know, get that community to see that there is value in ACM membership and, you know, value in interacting with the broader community.
Do you have an estimated time frame for the 2016 conference?
Yeah, it's going to be spring of 2016. We're looking at April. If you look at Applicative, if you go and search Applicative, you'll find the website, which should be up for 2016, including, you know, we don't yet have a call for submissions. We will have one soon. But information on the 2016 conference will be on the website.
Now, you were a speaker at the Applicative 2015 conference. Can you summarize some of the key points from your talk?
Sure. What I spoke about was time. So one of the areas that I've been working in for the last 7 or 8 years is highly accurate data center-based time. And what I discovered in working with distributed systems and time for that period is that most practitioners, most programmers, most software developers really don't have any idea of how time is kept on computers and the challenges of getting really accurate time is that's what you need for your application. And so what I did was I created a presentation which was an introduction to working with time for software engineers and practitioners that covered the very basics, how do computer clocks keep time and why are they accurate or inaccurate and what are the ways in which you can actually get good distributed time in, say, a data center environment, which is an area I've been working in, as I said, for quite a while. So that was the general gist of the talk. It ran the gamut from trying to explain to people just how inaccurate computer-based time is. People who work with computers sort of assume computers are accurate in every way because, for instance, they do math very accurately. But it turns out that they don't keep time very well, and that presents problems as time scales and distributed systems become smaller and smaller. So if you only needed to keep your computers within a second of each other, that was relatively easy for quite a long time. But once you start talking about, milliseconds, microseconds, and nanoseconds, you're starting to get into time scales where keeping 1,000 computers, on track with each other is non-trivial.
And that's fascinating. And, we don't have a lot of time to delve into more details on this area, but do you have something upcoming where people can find out more?
There's a few things. So I've been giving a talk about this in a few places. So I gave it at Applicative. There was a similar talk I gave at FOSDEM, which is the huge European open source conference that happens in Brussels every February. The talk itself, I also volunteered to turn my talk into a complete article for Q. So there will be a Q article which covers all the material that I covered in the talk this fall. I'm not sure which issue it's scheduled to be in, but I have submitted it, and it's in editing right now. So that's up to the editor. That's up to the editor which issue it shows up in. But it'll be in Q's magazine.
Yeah, and is there any webcaps coming up as well?
I believe there is a video of me giving the talk. We did capture a video for most of the applicative talks. I have not looked at that video. I hope that it's good. I don't really like to see myself on video very often. Oh, but I believe it's online.
So I was just thinking there's an upcoming webcast in the Learning Center.
Right. So that's true. So at the end of July, we're recording a webinar, actually, where I'll talk about these topics as well.
Now, you have an extremely popular column, and in fact, you're quite famous for it, in this Communications of the ACM magazine. Can you share some key tips from your column?
So, I mean, CodeVicious, which is what you're referring to, it started out in Q and actually is still in both Q and CACM. I wouldn't say there are key tips. There are certain key themes that you find in CodeVicious. One of the ones that we keep coming back to is testing. It does seem that no matter how much programmers claim they like to test their code, they're actually lying. So that theme is there a lot, talking about the need to test code, what's a good test, what's a bad test. Some of that is in there. I would say that if there were a key idea that always comes out in a CodeVicious piece, is generally question your assumptions. Right? So, software developers and practitioners I find to be optimists, right? They really want to believe that their stuff is going to work, because how could you spend all day banging your head against computer software if you didn't believe that at the end of the day it would work? But that optimism actually gets in the way of functioning in correct systems, because often problems creep in that you don't notice. We know that there's a very common problem of confirmation bias for software developers. So one of the things that really comes out of the CodeVicious piece is question your assumptions, because we all have them. You've got to find out what they are. Otherwise, you're going to have surprises in your software that you didn't like.
The evolution of this column, are practitioners able to interact with you in some way?
Sure. I mean, the column is written from letters that are written to CodeVicious. So there's if you go look at the CACM online website or the Q online website, there's an email address for kb@acmq.com, I think. But there are a couple of email addresses where people can write and send in questions. People are always welcome to send in questions. I always anonymize them. I will not put your name in print and then be snarky at you. So I will let you know that the letter is gone into print, but I will not put a person's name or company name into the source letters.
You know, it's interesting. You've been doing this very popular column for a while now. And is there some particular sort of letter that comes to mind where you think, wow, that's a really interesting point of view, and had you kind of pondering it for a bit?
So I've been doing the Code Vicious column for over a decade. And when I realized that, I sort of stood back and thought, wow, that's a really long time to be writing. I would say there isn't a particular letter that really stands out. The letters that I always find really refreshing and really fun are the ones that are reactions to another letter. So, you know, someone will write in, I'll write a response, and then someone will write a response to my response. So instead of being in, often now online, you see one paragraph fits in a comment, which aren't very interesting. Sometimes they are, but usually they're not. But what's most interesting is someone will write in, and I actually have two of these in my inbox at the moment. People have written significantly long, two-page letters saying, well, you said to this person this thing, but did you consider these other things? And that sort of conversational thing always stands out to me.
Have you ever considered converting some of those columns into a podcast or a book?
So the idea of a book actually has occurred to me, and one of the reasons to do a book is to do longer form. So Code Vicious columns tend to be two letters, two responses, about 1,500 words. And that's about as long as a column generally is in most magazines. And that's actually a fine form for me. I was raised writing essays for advanced placement classes in high school. So weirdly enough, that's where I learned to do that writing the first time. So, 1,500 words, it's about 750 per, the letter's 250, it's 500 words for a response, that kind of thing. So that style of writing is very easy for me. So I can just sit down and, look at what people have written and be like, oh, okay, I can write a response to this. The reason to do a book, which I have considered and I've talked to a couple people about, but if someone was in the audience and seriously interested in hooking up with a publisher, I'd make sure to email, would be to, have a couple of 3,000 to 5,000 word pieces in there where you can really, dig more deeply into a topic. In 500 to 600 words in a response, you're not going to be digging really deeply into a topic. You can make a very sharp single point. And that's an enjoyable form of writing for me, and it's something I've been able to do for over a decade, but I do a lot of other long-form writing. I've written books. So something that's medium form would be interesting for a Code Vicious book.
George, there's so much noise on the internet, and ICT professionals are bombarded with it. You've been in this field for so long, and you're so well-respected. Let's see if we can leverage your expertise. What are the kind of the top recommended resources you think that developers should look at based on all of this experience you've developed over the years?
So for me, finding good publishers of good books has always been useful. So I've been a book person since I was a very, very small child. The way in which I learned things as a kid was I just went to the library, found the section in the library that had the topics I cared about, and then read as many books in that section as I could. So I'm not much for following blogs or following sort of news sites. I look for things that are well-reasoned, longer than a blog entry. And there are the good bloggers. Schneier is always my counterexample to people who don't like blogging, because Bruce Schneier is just an amazing writer who does a really good job on his blog. In terms of learning new things, I find that over time there have been different publishers who put out better or worse books. When I was in college, it was the O'Reilly books. If you wanted to learn a topic on Unix or something, you went and found the O'Reilly book and you read that book, then you had a reasonable grounding and you learned how things worked. You look at Pearson if you want sort of the really high-end stuff. Donald Knuth's books are on Pearson. Every computer scientist should have Knuth's books on their shelf, and we should all read them. And unfortunately, none of us get all the way through them. They're just amazing books, but they require so much concentration. They're really, deep writing. And then it really depends on the topic area. A few years ago, quite a few years ago now, one of my columns, instead of answering a question, just flat out said, here are the books you should read. And I haven't refreshed that in a while. I think it's probably time to do so. Amusingly, one of my favorite books, which is Raj Jain, The Art of Computer Performance Analysis, which was written in 1991, and I've been recommending it to this day. That's going to be updated and published in 2015, according to the publisher's website. I have pre-ordered my copy. A lot of software practitioners really do not understand how to evaluate systems performance. And, you know, for the last, at least the last decade, probably the last 20 years, the way people solve systems performance has been to wait for better hardware to come along. But that's really not good engineering. That's change engineering. So, you know, understanding computer performance, I think, is something important to everyone in the industry, no matter what level of software they work at. So something like the Jain book is a great book. We'll see how the 2015 version is. I'm pretty certain it'll be good. He's a really great writer. The other issue with finding information, you know, in our industry is the number of software people who can understand software and explain it, in a way that is interesting, is very small. The list of books that I recommended a decade ago hasn't changed very much, right? You know, you've got writers like Jain and, you know, Richard Stevens, who passed away years ago, so people have been updating his books. You know, there's a Kirk McCusick, who I worked with on the design and implementation of FreeBSD, of the FreeBSD operating systems books. You know, people like that can really write, and write in a way that someone's going to want to read it, right? So it's hard to pick those books, and clearly I think it's time for me to update that list and go back and see what the new books are. One of my other recommendations, ACM has a bunch of books. They also have an arrangement with Safari, so you can get a bunch of the Safari books. And then recently I've come across the Pragmatic Bookshelf folks, and they, to me, are sort of the modern equivalent of the O'Reilly of, you know, 1990 or 1987. They're the ones doing books on specific technologies that are well-written to the point, and they're not, you know, no publisher is universally good, but, you know, they come through these cycles, right? And so the pragmatic programmer stuff is actually pretty good. I'd say that I still get the largest amount of my main information from books. I will look at trends, looking at, when there were the most recent revision control wars, right? You had Subversion, and you had Mercurial, and you had Git, and all that stuff. You sort of keep track of that just by following things online and in discussions and forums. But once the technology gets to the point of being broadly used, like, for instance, Subversion and Git are clearly the two current leaders in revision control, then it's time to sit down and see what someone has written seriously about them, because usually the manual pages are appalling. In particular, Git has some of the worst user interface and worst manual pages I've ever read. And I hope someone from that group is listening, because I want them to hear this. And so the only way to really understand a lot of that technology is to sit down with a book and play with the technology and figure out how it works. Same is true for all the new computer languages, right? Like, every week now, someone's got some new version of the Java VM underlying a language, or, you know, they've come up with some new web language. I try not to get sucked into the latest trend and sort of sit back for a few months and see where things go, unless someone specifically wants a piece of technology built on a specific thing by me, and then see where that technology goes and see if it really isn't going to be a flash in the pan.
You know, you've been sort of focusing specifically in the coding area or things that are related to coding. Let's maybe broaden that a bit. Are there any sort of trends on the broader basis in the computing area that you think are interesting and something that people have to start paying attention to, maybe deep learning or something like that?
Well, you got the machine learning stuff, but I don't work a lot in that area. I'd say, since I'm more of a systems person, the thing that I found amazing is everyone has spent the last, 5-7 years saying how important understanding multi-core and multi-processing is because of the way that hardware is now built. And that's one of those trends that people have been banging a drum about for a long time, but which I still do not see any good uptake of understanding of how that works to people. So, you know, in the software area, people have tried to paper it over with different kinds of languages. And in the, you know, systems performance area, people either ignore it or they deal with it when it becomes a massive emergency. But there's, if you look at the way And I've been thinking about this quite a bit because I'm working on an operating systems course for universities as well as for practitioners. If you look at the way that we teach about computer systems, we often teach about computer systems as if they are a VAX from 1980, right? You know, a big single processor, complex instruction set, maybe even graduate course and look at some stuff that's more interesting. But that particular trend, the move to multi-core and multi-processing, which really has fundamental changes for the way one should write software or build systems or, you know, size systems or think about how they're going to do them, I don't see that being taken up very well by the academy or by industry unless it's, you know, under a pain of you know, massive performance problems. I'd say the other area, you know, other areas to look at, you know, people talk about virtualization, but people have not really addressed a lot of the issues of virtualization. Everybody's willing to just move all their stuff to the cloud, but they ignore security. Often they ignore billing, performance, a whole bunch of things. They pretend as if every single virtual instance that's running in the cloud is exactly like a machine that they used to run it on. And I think that that is detrimental to good software and good engineering. So that's, you know, another big trend. The data analytics area, I think, is quite interesting. But I think that's more interesting from an interfacing with other people kind of idea. So, you know, we can do machine learning. We can throw all kinds of math at a bunch of large amounts of data, or what used to be large amounts of data. I always find the term big data amusing because big data depends on how big the disk is this year. But, you know, there's a large number of people working in that area. But where that area really makes sense is how you give usable, quantifiable, measurable, statistically relevant results to people who actually care about the problem, right? So, you know, in big data, what you really want to be able to do is do all your number crunching. But then the interesting problem there is how do you relate that to the social scientist who actually asked the question, right? How do we ask the right kind of questions of big data? You know, there's a whole bunch of issues there. And we've had people who were parts of the portrait series, in particular I'm thinking of Hillary Mason, who was at Bitly and is now off doing other kinds of data science. You know, people who really understand that interface between engineering and the people who wish to use the results of that engineering. I think that's a really interesting area for the big data science folks.
Well, George, you've given us some great advice here. Now we're down to our last question, and I'm going to turn the tables. If you were conducting this interview, what one, two, or three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Okay, so what would I have asked myself? I guess the first question, since we're thinking more broadly, and you know, I think it's always important to speak to the new people in the field, the people who are joining the field. You know, I'd be interested to, you know, if I were an undergraduate, what area I would ask someone like me, you know, what area of computer science, you know, you would study now. When people of my generation were studying computer science, there were not as many sub-disciplines of computer science. Is there any one that's particularly important? And my answer to that question would be stats. I think the number of computer scientists and people in computer science who don't properly understand statistics is going to be a big problem going forward. So I think the people who are doing undergraduate work should get a good, solid grounding in statistics because all of the data science stuff is all stats. A lot of the, you know, mathematical computing work, financial computing, a lot of that is based in statistics. And again, I talk a lot about performance because that's something interesting to my particular area of systems work. You can't really do performance analysis without understanding stats. If I were going to, you know, then try and figure out a question from someone who is, you know, in my stage of their career, right? So I'm probably mid-career at this point. You know, as a mid-career person, what should I be looking at next? I think the answer to that is you've always got to be looking for the next thing. So one of the biggest problems I find in any industry, and it happens even in the computer industry, is that people get stuck in a particular technology or a particular way of thinking or a particular way of building systems. And you've always got to be looking for what change is coming and what's new. I mean, I'm sure there are people still programming COBOL on Wall Street who get, you know, very good salaries because there's very few people left doing it. But you don't want to be that, or at least I don't want to be that programmer. You want to be looking ahead to see what's coming. And one of the ways to look ahead is to read things like magazine, to follow ACM, to really get involved in your industry and not treat it simply as a job you go to 9 to 5, but you know, what are the interesting problems and where am I going to be and what problems am I going to be solving in 2 years? That's the thing that I think you need to tell people, or that's the thing I'd expect to be asked and that I would tell people who are mid-career.
Do you have an advice for them for the mid-career? I guess you've given some in a prior question, but maybe some additional advice for somebody who's mid-career?
And I think, you know, you should plan to attend a conference once a year, no matter what that conference is, something that's of interest to you, something that's relating to an area you're interested in or an area you're currently working in, to keep current. I think it's all about keeping current, especially in something that moves as fast as computing technology.
So, George, I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. Thank you for sharing so much of your insights and your experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much. It's always good to talk to people about what's going on.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with George Novelle-Neal, a top international executive, software developer, entrepreneur, and ACM chair.